Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and please report. This case, like the case that the court just heard, involves an issue of discovery. But the issue is considerably less complex, although I think no less important. The issue raised by the state's petition for review, and in which the Court of Appeals granted a new trial to the defendant in this case, is whether the state reached its obligation to disclose to the defense, prior to trial, an oral statement made by defendant Media Dalal. Although the defendant raised two other issues in the Court of Appeals and has preserved those issues by briefing them in this court, it's my intention to limit my argument to the issue raised in our petition, so I will, of course, answer any questions the court may have with regard to those other issues. The defendant made the statement at issue to a Racine police detective, Detective James Prioletta, who was investigating an unrelated crime, an armed robbery of a grocery store in which the defendant's boyfriend, Desmond Salisbury, and another man, John Savara, were suspects. The robbery took place about a week before Salisbury shot Savara at the defendant's home. It was the defendant's actions after that shooting that gave rise to the charges against her in this case. The lead investigator in this case, Mount Pleasant officer Douglas Josie, learned about the defendant's statements to the detective Prioletta 2 days before trial in this case. However, investigator Josie did not inform the prosecutor about that statement until after trial had begun, because he did not realize until several hours after hearing defense counsel's opening statement that Dalal's statement to the detective was potentially relevant to this case. As soon as he was able to speak to the prosecutor after he had concluded his testimony on the second day of trial, investigator Chosi informed the prosecutor about the defendant's statements to Detective Prioletta, and the prosecutor then promptly informed the court in defense about the state's desire to use that statement in rebuttal should the defendant testify. The trial court, finding that the state had not violated its discovery obligations, permitted the state to use the statement in rebuttal. The court gave the defendant as much time as she desired to review Detective Prioletta's report and to interview the detective. The Court of Appeals held that the state had violated its discovery obligations. The court appeared to identify two grounds for its conclusion. The first was in the scope of the discovery request itself. Even though Section 971.23(1)(b) limits the state's obligations with regards to a defendant's oral statements to those statements that the district attorney plans to use in the course of the trial, the Court of Appeals noted that the defendant's discovery request here was not limited to those statements that the state intended to use at trial. The court also noted that the statements at issue were encompassed by the discovery demand, and that the state had not objected that the demand was overbroad or went beyond the scope of the statute. The Court of Appeals thus implied, if not expressly held, that the state is obliged to turn over everything requested in a defendant's discovery demand unless the state objects. If that were indeed the Court of Appeals holding, and it is difficult to read that Court of Appeals decision otherwise, it would radically restructure discovery rights in criminal cases. The defendant disagrees with the state with regard to whether that is what the Court of Appeals held, and in any event, she disavows any reliance on that rationale. Rather, the basis for her claim is the Court of Appeals' alternative argument, which is that the prosecutor and the police are treated as a single prosecutorial entity for purposes of discovery, and that the prosecutor in this case was therefore charged with investigator Chosey's knowledge prior to trial about the defendant's statements to Detective Prioletta. Under that interpretation of the statute, apparently, the prosecutor must disclose all oral statements of the defendant, known to the prosecutorial unit. The problem with that argument and that analysis is the plain language of section 971.23.1b. Under the statute, the state's obligation to disclose a defendant's statement is not triggered by the prosecutor's mere knowledge of the statement, or by the fact that someone else in the prosecutorial unit is aware of the statement. Now, there are some discovery obligations that are triggered by that kind of knowledge. For example, section 971.23.1f requires disclosure of the criminal record of a prosecution witness which is known to the district attorney. This court held in Jones v. State that the prosecutor's duty to disclose under this subsection extends to information known both to the prosecutor and to those agencies that participated in the investigation or evaluation of the case. However, the discovery statute treats oral statements of a defendant differently. It expressly and unambiguously limits the state's obligation to disclose oral statements of a defendant to those, quote, which the district attorney plans to use in the course of trial, unquote.
Counsel, your reading, then, of Jones is much more narrow than the Court of Appeals. You take ask for that. I note that their reading of Jones says, Wisconsin courts have held that the prosecutorial unit, which includes both the district attorneys and law enforcement offices, must be viewed as one unit for the purposes of the discovery process, citing Jones at 348-49. So their interpretation of Jones is much broader than yours.
That's right. And I think that interpretation is correct when the obligation extends to those items that are within the knowledge of the state or control and custody of the state. Certainly, the state wouldn't dispute that if we were talking about a written statement of the defendant, that whether the prosecutor knew about it or not, if an investigative agency involved in this case had that written statement or recorded statement, there would be an obligation to disclose. The key difference here is that the oral statement statute, the legislature made a decision to treat oral statements differently, and it is keyed to the intent of the prosecutor.
Is the prosecutor obligated to obtain all evidence in the possession of the agencies who have investigated?
I think that is also perhaps an overly broad statement. The source of that statement, also in Jones and I believe the Wald case, is the ABA standards for the prosecutor function. And as I went back and looked at that, it strikes me that the context in which the ABA was talking about that obligation of the prosecutor and in which this court applied it had to do with providing evidence, in Jones, for example, the criminal record of the defendant that is exculpatory or at least helpful to the defense. And Jones quotes this portion of the ABA standard, which talks about a prosecutor's duty. The section is intentional ignorance of facts. And the ABA says, just as it is unprofessional conduct for defense counsel to adopt the tactic of remaining intentionally ignorant of relevant facts known to the accused in order to give him a free hand in the defense, it is unprofessional conduct for the prosecutor to engage in a comparable tactic. He may not properly refrain from investigation in order to avoid coming into possession of evidence which may make it this case. We're talking about evidence that is not helpful to the defense. I don't know that there is any obligation of the prosecutor to seek out anything from the detective which may potentially be probative of the defendant's guilt. And
I do have a question. Thank you. You're omniscient, if you can tell by my face. That's good. If this court were to find a violation, does the state concede the violation would be prejudicial? By that, I use that as a preface to point to the Court of Appeals opinion that paragraph 28, it says that the defendant was caught on the horns of a dilemma. Placed in that position by the state, either she must testify and accept the consequences of impeachment or break her promise to the jury that she would testify and accept the consequences of her broken promise. No judicial remedy would suffice, essentially. That sounds like the horns of a dilemma that's they see as per se prejudicial. Are you in agreement that if there's a violation, that the defendant experiences that horns, those horns of a dilemma which are prejudicial?
Not at all. I think the dilemma that the Court of Appeals was perceiving was that defense counsel said defendant's going to take the stand. I think this would hardly be the first case in which there was a suggestion to the jury in an opening that the defendant was going to take the stand, and the defendant ended up not taking the stand. There would be instructions saying that you cannot hold it against the jury, against the defendant, that the defendant did not take the stand. More importantly, I made the argument in my brief in this court that I don't see that the defendant, that there has never been an assertion that the defendant, had she known of this statement prior to trial, would have made a different decision. Her defense was coercion. It was uncontested that she picked up the shotgun shells. It was uncontested that she lied to the police. Really, the only alternative was coercion, if there were going to be some sort of affirmative defense made. And there just is no indication in the record whatsoever that had the defense known of this statement, she would not have tried that for the defense.
Now, in this case, about the word sandbag, if we were to say that, okay, based on the facts, no one tried to, this was all legitimate, but here, you have the lead investigator, or the people directly involved with this robbery, the intertwining of this case, and it seems to me, and maybe you have a good answer for this, that the state always has an ongoing requirement to disclose statements. So they knew about this 2 days ahead of time, and of course the prosecutor said, well, she wasn't going to use it, she hadn't intended to do it, but she knew what the defense theory was, that the defendant was going to get on the stand and testify. She did not.
I mean, there is the trial court specifically found that there was no indication prior to opening statements that the defendant was going to get on the stand and raise a coercion defense. So that's not the case. Prosecutor did not know about the statement prior to trial.
Right, he knew it then, and when was it disclosed?
No, the prosecutor did not learn of the statement until day two of the trial. The sequence was that investigators...
I understand it, but I guess it's the unit. So you're saying as long as the prosecutor himself or herself does not know this, then that shields the prosecution from this sandbag argument, but if it's going to be helpful, then they can bring it in, and then they can say, well, I didn't know it. That doesn't seem to be fair.
Well, I look to the language of the statute, which speaks in terms of the prosecutor's intent to use it at trial. There certainly has been no suggestion here that there was any conscious sandbagging by the investigator. But if you look at the language of the statute, my argument is that the knowledge of the prosecutorial unit is irrelevant. It is a necessary condition for disclosure that the prosecutor know of the statement.
Oh, so that squares with the Ruiz case. I was just looking at the State versus Ruiz, which was
a
rule on other grounds, but it does. It seems to indicate that in total, you know, you have to disclose.
Now, I read the Ruiz statement as rejecting the argument till the prosecutor makes the absolute. The argument of the state apparently was, well, the prosecutor was still weighing, was he going to use the statement or not? And I think the court in that circumstance was concerned about the possibility of gamesmanship by a prosecutor saying, well, sorry, I didn't, you know, I was weighing it over, but I really didn't make a final decision. I think in a case like that, a trial court could deal with it. A trial court could make the conclusion that you're playing games here, you know of it, and you intended to use it. I don't believe it. You weren't planning to use it. I think that scenario doesn't work here because the prosecutor clearly was not playing games. She disclosed it as soon as she found out. I think the case that's more comparable is the Larson case, where there was a statement, this is a court of appeals decision, there was a statement the defendant made to a fellow jail inmate that the prosecutor knew about for weeks, but didn't disclose until the defendant filed a notice of alibi. And the court of appeals said, until that notice of alibi was filed, the statement, the defendant's statement was not relevant. And that's the case here. Even had the prosecutor known, she didn't, until the defendant at opening statement has said, here's what my defense is going to be. I'm going to take the stand and I'm going to testify this. When a statement is admissible only in a rebuttal, and that's the only relevance of the statement at issue, is a rebuttal statement. It had, I guess I'd take issue with, I think Justice Wilcox in his view, who said this was intertwined, and the Court of Appeals certainly said it was. This statement, even had the prosecutor known about it in advance, would not have been admissible in the state's case.
Well, I guess what I was saying is that the investigations were intertwined.
I disagree with that. There are some of the cast of characters intertwines, but the first investigation involves a robbery.
But it just seems to me that when it's common sense that it was well known that this person was going to have a trial and that she was being tried for these various charges, and then 2 days before, and all I'm saying is that the investigator is out talking to her about this robbery.
It was the investigator. It was the receiver.
Intertwined is an inappropriate word, but certainly you would assume that this isn't, it's not Milwaukee, but it's certainly that these departments knew what was going on as far as her being tried at that time.
But the record, I think, is clear that Detective Prioletta, when he was investigating, when he spoke to the defendant about that robbery, didn't ask her any questions about what took place a week later at her place. She wasn't charged with the robbery. She wasn't even charged as an aider and abettor in the shooting. All of her activities, her crime, was cleaning up afterwards. Cleaning up afterwards of the shooting. It had nothing to do with the robbery. So I guess...
Yeah, so what was the response of the trial judge when he was faced? Other than ultimately to allow the testimony, what was his response? Did he allow some time for the opposing counsel?
Absolutely. He bent over backwards to say, well, first, when it came to light, Detective Prioletta had not yet even written a report. So the court determined that Detective Prioletta could prepare a report in a few hours. So the court recessed to do that. And the report had been prepared. I believe it was a 6-page report. The court said, I'm going to give the defense as much time as it wants to look over the report, and the defense can take as much time as it wants to interview Detective Prioletto. The defense had an opportunity to interview Detective Prioletto. So the court's response, after having found that there was no discovery violation, was to do everything possible to give the defendant an opportunity to investigate the statements.
Mr. Hassel, I'm struck, not struck, but I note that the discovery request by the defendant was quite broad. It was not limited only to statements the defendant, or the district attorney intended to use. So do you concede anyway, at the very least, that had the district attorney known about these statements, the district attorney would have had to turn them over because of the failure to object?
I don't concede that at all, because that there is no requirement under the discovery statute to provide all information requested by a defendant. We don't, in criminal cases, use the civil model. The civil model of discovery is wide open. Anything that might potentially lead to relevant evidence.
So your position is that the state had no duty to object to the breadth scope of the discovery request and could take back anything they didn't intend to use at trial, even if she knew about this statement.
Absolutely.
No due process, no nothing.
I think the constitutional right to discovery is extremely narrow. It's Brady materials and a few other types of materials.
The defendant, in your view, can win either on the statute or can't win at all.
Correct. And I think, you know, the discovery request in this case isn't atypical. I mean, if, as the court, I'm sure, is familiar, discovery requests are often rather boilerplate. And they go from request number 1 through 20, ending with the request here that says, and anything else having anything possibly to do with the case under the letter or the spirit of the statute. I don't think the state has an obligation to go through items 1 through 20. What the state's obligation is to provide what is indicated in section 921.23.
So even if the district attorney knows of the existence of this statement, knows of the potential, I'm not saying it's existent here, but knows of the potential that the defendant may assert a defense of fear, you know, theory of the defense of fear. The district attorney can nevertheless sit back, not disclose the statement, and then say tough when the defendant shows his or her hand, so to speak, at the opening statement.
Under your scenario, if the district attorney has that obligation, it would be because of the statute, not because of the discovery request.
And you say there's no such statute.
And I say there's no such statute. Now, I think clearly the trial court can deal with gamesmanship. I think the way the statute is structured, which places the obligation on the district attorney in terms of what she intends to use at trial, places an obligation on the state to act in good faith. There's no question that the state is not suggesting that, contrary to what apparently was characterized as the state position in Ruiz, is, well, I'm wavering. Maybe I'll use the statement, maybe I won't. That kind of gamesmanship to say, well, I'm sorry, we just didn't decide until 3 days of the trial that I'm going to use it. But I think that's the kind of thing that the trial court can deal with. And the trial court dealt with here by saying, made a finding that there just was no way, even if the statement had been known, that it would have been relevant to the case in chief and that whether the state would have used it in trial.
Isn't it common counsel, like in a common counsel, isn't it common that the state doesn't know whether or not a defendant is going to testify until either opening statement or until the defendant takes the stand? That's my experience oftentimes. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Well, then you're saying, it seems to me, a statement, now we're talking of a defendant here, you know, as opposed to some of the cases cited deal with statements of witnesses. We're talking about a statement of a defendant. So a prosecutor may not plan to use the statement of the defendant until the prosecutor knows whether or not the defendant's going to testify. And so by your interpretation of the rule, under the normal circumstance, a prosecutor is not required to turn over a defendant's own statement to the defendant, no matter how many months taken in advance of trial, no matter any of that, until the moment that the prosecutor knows that he or she's going to use it, which might be the third or fourth day of trial when the defendant has showed the hand as to whether or not they're going to testify.
Literally,
that's your interpretation.
Literally speaking, I think that's what the statute says. Now, I think this case clearly is different in the sense that the prosecutor didn't know before trial.
But in your analysis of the statute,
that
is irrelevant.
It is.
It's irrelevant.
Right.
In your interpretation of the statute.
Yes. Now, I think whether the court would read the statute to say that the prosecutor should reasonably anticipate that she might use a trial. If that's what plan to intend means.
I think plans to intend, well, if you want to open up plans to intend to might use a trial, I would suggest any time a prosecutor has a defendant's statement, that might be used at trial. So
I resist that interpretation because I think it then becomes open-ended. Again, under the facts of this case, I still, no matter what, a prosecutor cannot intend to use the statement of which she has knowledge. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Assistant Public Defender representing the defendant. Before you proceed, let me welcome two important students from Wayland Academy. Students, would you please stand? You may be seated. Thank you for coming. We have had numerous classes from Wayland Academy over the course of the last 7 years. They're our Courtroom class program, and we welcome you. You will, I think, be meeting with a justice at noon to discuss these procedures, but I have not been given another Justice Sykes. I have just been advised in a very formal way that you will be meeting with Justice Sykes. So I almost introduce the court to you all, and I'll start with Justice Sykes, who is on our, my far left. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Brooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Ballinger. And to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Rosser. With those introductions made, we will now hear from your counsel representing the defendant.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to begin by telling the court what I think this case is not about and what I think this case is about. This case is not about, in any way, shape, or form, a new rule of discovery or expanded discovery beyond the statute. Ms. DeLeo never asserted in the trial court or in the Court of Appeals that the statement involved here was anything other than a routine 971.23 statement. The state in the trial court, the state in the Court of Appeals in defending this appeal, never once suggested this statement anyway exceeded the scope normal statutory discovery. That issue was never briefed. It arose for the first time in the state's petition for review. And in my response to that petition, we said, we're not asserting that. That's not an issue. And the state, in its reply brief, conceded that if we were not asserting the right to discovery beyond the statute, that was not an issue in this case. What this case is about, in my opinion, is the simple, straightforward application of 25 or 30 years of this court's precedent, starting with Lowell versus the state, through Jones, through every other discovery case, including the Ruiz case, as Justice Wilcox mentioned. Those cases stand for a simple proposition that knowledge will be imputed to the prosecutor if that knowledge is within the possession of the prosecutorial agencies, and if the prosecutor could have, with due diligence, discovered that information.
Mr. Weiss, if he's going to rely on precedent, how do you handle State versus Larson? It seems to me that State versus Larson is very similar to this particular.
State versus Larson is, in many ways, not at all similar to this case.
How is it different?
State versus Larson was a pretrial appeal. A week before trial, the state made disclosure, and the defense sought it in the trial court to exclude the evidence. The trial court said, no, I'm going to give you as much pretrial adjournment as you want. But I'm not going to exclude the statement because you have plenty of time to deal with it, and I'm going to give you an adjournment to the trial if you want. And that's the precedent of Larson.
Didn't the trial court here give all the time that was necessary under the circumstances?
This was in the midst of trial. This was not pre-trial. The statute says, Your Honor, that within a reasonable time before trial, disclosure shall be made. And in Larson trial, the only issue in Larson was whether there should be exclusion or adjournment at that point in time prior to trial. There was pre-trial disclosure made in Larson.
So
in this case, it was mid-trial.
You think it's much different because this arose during the course of trial?
I think it changes everything, and I'm going to give you some examples of why I think it changes everything.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that there was prejudice to the defendant here because the trial judge was not allowing enough time for preparation?
No, the issue in this case was not an adjournment situation. The issue in this case was the inherent prejudice in preparation for trial and planning a trial strategy and in proceeding through the entire state's case of the trial and the defendant's opening arguments with a view and an understanding of what evidence the state had. When that lawyer got up, Mr. Lael's attorney got up in front of that jury and promised and said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client is going to testify today. She's going to tell you these things happened. That lawyer didn't know about these statements that were going to be used against her client. And there's no way that that lawyer could have initiated in the midst of trial after the state had rested any changes that could have erased that tape. She made a promise to the jury, and several of your honors I know have been trial judges, and you're aware of what happens after you tell the jury something and then you change. Has it ever happened? Certainly. Do I think it's prejudicial in this case? Did the Court of Appeals agree unanimously that it was prejudicial in this case? Absolutely.
I don't remember, was there a motion for a mistrial after the judge announced that the evidence would not be excluded?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
That obviously was also true. Now, if I understand your position, it is that this request is covered by the statute, even if the state did not intend to use this.
Well, that was the third point I was going to make.
Okay, I'll get to
the beginning. And yes, the short answer is yes. And I think that this court has to tread very slowly, be very careful of how narrowly we interpret intend to use. The state's asking this court for two, what I think are very radical changes in the discovery procedure. I'm going to show you why that is. First, it would overrule the whole collective knowledge ruling precedent from Lowell and Jones, because as Mr. Castle said many times, it's irrelevant to this analysis. It only comes down to intends to use. And he made an example that, well, certain evidence must come in regardless of the statutory language intends to use. But what Mr. Castle didn't mention, what I think the court has to pay very close attention to, is almost every provision in the discovery statute, 971.23, is premised on intends to use. Witness lists are limited to witnesses which either party, and now we have reciprocal discovery with the defense. And evidence is limited on witness lists to witnesses that the party intends to call. Scientific evidence is limited to evidence the parties intend to present. So if we're going to start tampering and making a very narrow restriction there, we have to really know, we have to look over the edge of the cliff here. The most classic example from my side of the table, being a defense attorney all my life, is that when I go to trial, when my colleagues go to trial, we don't know if we're going to present any evidence at all until after we hear the whole state's case. Many times, the defense lawyer will sit through trial, the state will present its case, and they'll think, well, I could put the defendant on, I could put these witnesses on, but they're all a little shaky, they have some criminal convictions, the state's case is pretty weak. I'm going to roll the dice and argue with the jury right now. Defense, state rests, defense rests, ready for argument. It eliminates rebuttal, it's a tactical decision that's made at that moment. So if we're going to start allowing lawyers to make disclosure based on the instant that they make the decision, as Mr. Gaston suggests, to use the evidence, don't expect to see any discovery coming from the defense, because the defense may not present any evidence until they decide to. And I can assure you that it's going to come up if this court adopts that narrow of a ruling that one needs to use.
Mr. Weiss, maybe you've got more to say on this, but so far you haven't convinced me. Because I start off with the assumption here that the prosecutor did not intend to use that statement. And I'm assuming that the prosecutor is charged with the knowledge of that statement. But the prosecutor did not intend to use that statement. And those are the words of the statute. Why do you say that the statute requires the prosecutor to reveal this if the prosecutor says you don't have to reveal it if you don't intend to use it, when the statute says it?
Well, I think any reasonable view of the statute would be that we say that if it starts with knowledge, my assumption is that any reasonable view of this case would say that once she had that knowledge, or is charged with that knowledge, there's no question but that she intended to use it. She intended to use it the instant she found out about it.
Why would she intend to use a statement made to an officer that she had no fear of this fellow that she was living with or whatever? Because she didn't have the foggiest notion, the prosecutor did not have the foggiest notion that the theory of the defense was going to be, I wouldn't have done this because I did this because I feared.
Well, that's simply not the record in this case, Justice Babbage. From the very first night of this crime, Investigator Chose interviewed Ms. DeLay. He's the lead investigator. He made the arrest. She said her very first statement to him, I did what I did because Desmond Stahlberg was acting crazy and I was afraid of him. There was extensive questioning at the preliminary hearing of Investigator Chose about whether or not DeLay would begin to fear to him. There was a suppression hearing in which statements concerning fear were discussed and litigated. And certainly by any stretch of the imagination, on Tuesday morning, after the lawyer gave opening statements and said, my defense is coercion, well, Investigator Jose is sitting right there, and he knew about the statements the day, 2 days before on Sunday, yet he still never said to the district attorney, hey, I've got something here that's going to be a statement of Ms. DeLeo, undercutting her entire defense. So I don't think there's any reasonable way to look at this case and not conclude that the instant that prosecutor was aware of that statement, it was a statement likely to be used at that trial by her. It was tremendous evidence.
Is your argument even broader? Maybe not. That the prosecutor has to look at defenses when they're prosecuting the case, when you're preparing for argument, when you're preparing your witnesses. That coercion is a defense. And here, most of these statements is quite possible that it will be presented. Therefore, a prosecutor must have in the back of his or her mind that they're going to use coercion statement or a conflicting statement if the issue is presented in that intends to use means, intends to use, if it turns out to be relevant. You have to add those words. Aren't you really adding those words?
No, I think certainly if it appears to be relevant, it would be a reasonable interpretation. My personal view is that intends to use has to be viewed in a common sense, objective, reasonable standard, that if viewing the evidence from afar, it would have appeared to an ordinary, reasonable observer or reviewer, as this court is, that this is evidence that would have been used, and that's
might have been used under certain circumstances. That might have been used under certain circumstances.
Yes. Well, that was likely to have been used, yes. And in this case, something that we keep missing, or it seems to slide by rather quickly in terms of, well, the prosecutor didn't know about this until Ms. DeLay was literally being called to the witness stand, and therefore she couldn't have known. And it's intermingled with this argument that, well, perhaps they didn't know what the defense was until opening statements. Opening statements happened the day before Ms. DeLeo came to the witness stand. And yet, after the opening statements, there was still no disclosure made for a day and a half. We went through a full day of trial and another half a day of trial, still with no disclosure after the opening statements. I really see this case as just a very simple application of the world. It was not about, let me back up just a second. Another point I'd like to address is that Mr. Castle suggested that, well, perhaps the Jones case dealt with exculpatory evidence, and perhaps the collective knowledge requirement is more applicable to exculpatory evidence. But in this case, and in the Wald case itself, it was inculpatory evidence. Wald itself involved scientific evidence that the prosecutor was unaware of. Prosecutor called a lab analyst not knowing about additional tests that had been done that were inculpatory. And the lab analyst presented the inculpatory evidence, and this court said that it should have been excluded.
Except the point was that the Wald decision was based on ABA standards of prosecutorial conduct, which pertain to the duty to search out and discover exculpatory evidence.
The ABA standards.
So it was sort of an extrapolation off of that that was perhaps unwarranted by the ABA standard itself.
If this court wants to limit Wald 25 or 30 years later, or perhaps reverse Wald, that would be true. But Wald was an inculpatory evidence case. Yes, those ABA standards that this court adopted in Wald were specific in their own discussion on the issue of exculpatory evidence. But make no mistake that that has always been applied to inculpatory evidence in Wisconsin.
Well, let me ask you this, though. If the Wald Jones rule of imputed knowledge, has it ever been applied to one of the subsections in 971.23 that turns on this triggering event of intent to use at trial? And if not, does it make any sense to imply a rule of imputed knowledge where the thing that triggers the duty to disclose is intent to use at trial? Because how can a prosecutor ever formulate an intent to use something at trial when that something is something that he or she only has imputed knowledge of? Does that make any sense under a
I understand the question, and the answer is yes. It's always been applied to imputed knowledge writers. It was applied in Wald to imputed knowledge rather than direct knowledge. It was applied in
Wald. No, I'm talking about those subsections of 971.23 that pertain to intent to use at trial, where the duty to disclose does not otherwise exist and is only triggered upon the prosecutor's plan or decision.
Yes. Yes, the scientific evidence disclosure falls under, I believe, intends to use. And Wald was a scientific report case itself, and that falls under an intends to use subsection in 971.23 as to the statement in Ruiz.
Mr. Weiss, so what should the prosecutor have done in this situation?
I think that a reasonable duty, I mean, the duty which has been imposed on the prosecutor by this court in Wald and Jones, is the duty to obtain all evidence within be control or possession of the state or its prosecutorial agencies. I think in this case, it would have been very simple and very reasonable for the prosecutor to have said to Investigator Jose before the beginning of the trial, this is a matter she has designated her right arm, her chief investigator, her courtroom aide. Simply say to him, say, excuse me, investigator, are there any other statements of the defendant taken by the police while she was in custody before we start trial here today that I should know about? All that would have taken.
Suppose she didn't do that. Yes, exactly the same facts. The statement comes to light. What should she have done?
Well, she would have disclosed it, presumably, then.
Well, she doesn't learn until after the trial has started.
Well, perhaps I misunderstood the second part of the question.
Let's take all the facts as they occurred here. She doesn't learn until after the trial is well underway. What should she have done at that point?
Should have not used it.
Well,
I think at the point that we're at, the whole problem, the reason the court feels reversed the case was, at that moment, there's nothing that we can do to fix it. The egg is broken. We can't put it back together.
Well, what would have happened if she had disclosed it but not used it?
If she had disclosed it and not used it, there wouldn't have been any problem. It was the use that created the problem.
Would she have subsequently used it in the perjury prosecution?
I suppose so. In a separate subsequent prosecution?
Well, she wouldn't have been discovered evidence, would it?
Well, I think I'm agreeing. If she wanted to use it in some other case, some other time, I don't see any problem with that.
Well, I'm thinking of a...
But I don't see her using it in this case.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a football analogy. When the defense is offside, the offense is a free play. Okay. Now, under the facts of this case, If the prosecution discloses this information that's just come to light, but you're able to put on the defendant and say something that might be subject to perjury, but it can't be used in a perjury trial. That's a little unsettling to me.
I didn't suggest it couldn't be used in a perjury trial. That would be a subsequent new criminal. Ms. DeLeo had committed perjury, certainly that statement or any other evidence could have been used at a subsequent trial. I didn't mean to suggest it couldn't. But that would be a subsequent proceeding. The issue that the Court of Appeals was dealing with is, what do we do now in this case? And I'd like to address a point that Justice Wilcox raised concerning how intertwined these cases were or were not between Mr. Stalzberg and Ms. DeLeo, and I think a very important fact here is that the only reason that Officer Prioletta ever went to talk to Ms. DeLeo, and the court should be clear that she was incarcerated for these charges at the time that Officer Prioletta questioned her. She was in custody of the police on this case. But the reason that Officer Prioletta went to see Ms. DeLeo in the very first place was because Investigator Chose, the lead investigator in this case, in DeLeo's case, told Prioletta to go talk to DeLeo about Stalzberg and his activities. And we can't forget that. Prioletta was not conducting an independent investigation and ran into Ms. DeLeo through that investigation. He saw Ms. DeLeo only after Investigator Chose said, go talk to Medea DeLeo. And then the other thing we can't forget is that for some reason, Investigator Chose decided to have a meeting and debrief Investigator Prioletta on the Sunday before Investigator Chose was beginning Medea DeLeo's trial. So these are far from parallel lines that somehow intersected through no actions or affirmative choices made by the police. Investigator Chose pulled all the strings here. He sent Prioletta to talk to DeLeo, and he debriefed Prioletta 2 days before DeLeo's trial. So under those circumstances, I don't see how it possibly could be argued that these were unrelated investigations. Realita didn't know about DeLeo until Chelsea sent him there. Well, if the court has any other questions about this issue, I'd be happy to address them further. I would like to address some of the other issues in the case. I'm not sure how the court would like to proceed in that regard.
So, I interrupted you at one point. You had 3 points you were making. So if you go back and just state those 3 points and make sure you got them covered on this issue, I would appreciate that.
The first point is simply that this case does not involve an expansion of discovery beyond the statute. Our position is that the statements were clearly statements covered by 97123. And the second point was simply that it's a straightforward case applying the time-honored collective knowledge standard. And on the unique facts here, the collective knowledge really can't be denied because of all the interrelationships and because of Investigator Chose's central role in the DeLeo prosecution and his connection toward Prioletta talking to DeLeo. And the third point was simply that this court really needs to take a very long, hard look at adopting the state's suggestions, limiting collective knowledge, and limiting the intends to use language to the moment when the attorney actually intends to use it. Because I think that the problems that we'll be creating are far greater than the occasional mishap that's occurred now. The court has to bear in mind that we're not arguing for a new approach here. This is one criminal case that was reversed due to either inadvertent or advertent error on the part of Officer Jose and the collective knowledge requirement with the district attorney.
Counsel, do you agree that if you don't fall within 971.23(1)(b), even though you ask for the information, you're not entitled to get it on discovery?
I'm not prepared to. I can't agree with that because I've never really looked into that. It's just never been argued or briefed. I really, off the top of my head, would hate to sort of suggest that.
The position is everyone has always argued that it's within or not within.
That's true. This case, I think that this case was decided that it was within. There's a sentence which I would describe as dicta in the Court of Appeals opinion, simply pointing out that there was a generalized, broad discovery request that went unobjected. But there was no real analysis of that by the Court of Appeals, and I would hesitate to try and argue for a new rule of law on this record at this point.
971.23(1)(b) uses the word, a summary of all oral statements. That's what we're rendering.
Yes.
Of the defendant, which the district attorney plans to use. The other subsections use the word intends to use. Do you see any difference?
I don't, Your Honor. And I thought about that, and I looked at that pretty closely. And they seem to have used language in about most of the time intends to use. And in that one, for some reason, it says plans to use. I did a little bit of statutory, research. I was unable to find any significance to the language change. The defense disclosures generally use the word intends to use as well, as opposed to plans. But I'd be hard-pressed to make a distinction between plans and intends.
I'm still kind of puzzled by your assertion that this Court of Appeals opinion does not create a new rule or expand the statute beyond its terms, because it clearly does create a duty to disclose sooner than the formulation of a plan or intent to use the evidence.
I think it doesn't, Justice Sykes, and the reason I think it doesn't is because ever since at least Mould, the statute says that reasonable time before trial. Now, as we all know, in a trial, a lawyer may change a strategy. But I don't think there's any fair way to say that if this prosecutor was imputed with collective knowledge or actual knowledge of this statement, that it wouldn't have been a statement that, in an honest, fair way of looking at it, she wouldn't have planned to use at trial in the event that Ms. DeLeo testified that she was afraid of Mr. Stallsberg. It's the evidence is so powerful and so obvious if you know a defendant is going to take the stand or may take the stand and say, I was afraid of him, and you have a statement from that defendant, I'm not afraid of him, it's inconceivable that she wouldn't have planned to use it had she been aware of it.
Which of the other subsections in the statute turn on this, or hinge on this intent or plan to use at trial? Physical evidence, right? Sub G?
Yes, specifically sub BM, sub D. This witness lists actually involve that. I mean, it's pretty much everything. Everything under E, which are witness statements, and any physical evidence under sub G. And then if we turn to the defense disclosure in 2M, once again, it's virtually everything. It's a list of witnesses whom the defendant intends to call.
Right, and
scientific evidence, witness statements, and physical evidence. Again, all are premised on intends to call.
So, isn't it very commonplace in the course of criminal trials that strategies do change depending upon how the evidence comes in? And something that you may have had no intent whatsoever as an attorney in the case of using at trial, or witness you may not have intended to call, or a piece of physical evidence that is on the police inventory list among hundreds of other items of physical evidence that you had no intention to use at trial, all of a sudden gains relevancy, and through this imputed knowledge rule, even if the DA didn't look at it or know about it, she or he is deemed to have that knowledge of it, and so therefore the duty. That just doesn't seem to comport with how the reality of these trials go.
I think that's why this court, the courts of appeals, and all the writers and all the people that have been involved in the discovery issues have always counseled toward the broadest view of the discovery pre-trial. So if there's something that you think, well, in this contingency I'm going to need this witness, and in that contingency I'm going to need that witness, that's why you put them on the witness list, and then you don't use them if you don't need to, but you disclose them you want them.
But nobody can anticipate everything.
That's true, and occasionally things come up, but by and large, this prosecutor certainly could have foreseen the contingency that she would want to use this defendant's statements that she never feared the man that she claimed to be afraid of. This isn't even a close case to me, Justice Sleeks.
Counsel, what's the usual, if there is such a thing, practice in terms of letting people add to the witness list after a trial has started, or bring in such people as there are tough showing made? You need to do that, or is it discretion of the trial judge, or what, none of the above, and what you don't know. It's okay if you don't.
It is a discretionary call on the part of the trial judge to allow a witness to be added late. And again, the same kinds of considerations that had to be made in this case would be made at that point, is undue surprise, prejudice, the adequacy of a remedy to be fashioned that would allow for the orderly presentation of evidence. Again, yes, it's discretionary. Yes.
Would you address the amendment to the information issue, please?
Yeah, I'd like to have an opportunity to do that, and I'd be happy to. In this case, and it's set forth in detail in the brief, so I won't belabor the facts because I'm running low on time here, but Ms. Lay was originally charged with obstruction, which is a misdemeanor for providing false information to the police, and she was charged with the harboring felony, specifically premised on tampering with evidence and sanitizing the crime scene after Stalsberg shot his former cohort at DeLeo's house. And DeLeo was specifically alleged to have picked up some shotgun casings, and there was an allegation that she had washed some blood off the porch, that sort of thing. And there were some other charges involved that are not relevant to this discussion. And they went through the entire trial. And at the jury instruction conference, after the state had rested and the defense had rested, the district attorney asked for the first time permission to amend the information to add an additional harboring charge, another felony, premised on the theory that Ms. DeLeo had provided false information to the police, which aided Stalzberg in evading capture. That's slightly different from the obstructing charge under the elements-only test, which does not require an intent to aid in an evasion of capture.
Okay, we've got no issue of lesser included here. These are two separate versions of the offense. And
they
state could have charged both from the beginning.
Yes, they could. But the problem here is they didn't charge that entire other theory with entirely different elements until after the trial was over. So Ms. DeLeo was never afforded any notice whatsoever that she was going to be tried for materially aiding Stalzberg in evading escape by providing false information to the police.
She was on notice that those facts were in play, essentially, and would be litigated in connection with the obstructing charge?
Yes and no. From the defense side, we frequently argue that we should have a fact-based test for when one crime fits into another. And this court has always steadfastly maintained that we look strictly at the elements. And there are elements in the obstructing charge that are not in the harboring charge, and there were elements that were not in the other. So while the factual predicate is the same, there are clearly different legal issues and different legal facts.
Right, but that analysis goes to double jeopardy, multiplicity sorts of arguments, and what we're talking about here is the notice requirement for purposes of amending the information. It's undisputed that Ms. DeLeo and her trial counsel were on notice that those facts were at issue, although in the form of an obstructing charge as opposed to a second and separate and different harboring charge.
No, I have to disagree respectfully, because the facts that were at issue that would allow proof of the harboring charge include specific facts as to how there was materially aided, how those facts materially aided Mr. Stalzberg in escaping. In avoiding apprehension. He was arrested, according to the police, somewhat later than he might have been otherwise had Mr. Leo been more cooperative. He was apprehended shortly thereafter. So she was not on notice that she had to specifically defend against the charge that she materially aided his evasion. And there was no notice of that. She was able to come up with a complete defense. She was acquitted of the original harboring charge because she was able to demonstrate to the jury's satisfaction that whatever it was she did or didn't do there did not materially aid Mr. Stalzberg. Had she been on notice that she was being charged that her statements were going to materially aid Mr. Stalzberg, she might have been able to question the police witnesses, for example, about, well, what did you do based on my statement that you would have done otherwise, and how did that materially affect Mr. Stalzberg's escape? And she never knew to ask this. She never knew that was an issue in the case. She wasn't charged with that crime until after the evidence was closed. My lights are on.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
I'd also like the court to consider the jury management issue, which is set forth.
You're resting on your brief on all other issues, as is the state, as I understand the positions of both of you. Okay? Mr. Cass.
The Chief Justice asked Mr. Weiss whether he was willing to disavow what appears to be the Court of Appeals' first rationale in terms of the unobjected-to scope of the discovery request, and Mr. Weiss said, I'm not willing to go that far. From the state's perspective, I would say if you don't agree with a single other argument that I make today, the state would ask this court clarify that the state's discovery obligation is limited to that which is constitutionally required and that which is required by the scope of the statute, absent an order by the court that some other discovery is to be provided.
What you're really asking is that the state doesn't have to object to a discovery order that it thinks exceeds the constitutional or statutory requirements. It can just hold the information, deal with it later.
It's under no obligation to discuss.
Right. even if in this particular case it was obliged to disclose this under the statute, should the court so hold?
Correct.
Okay. That's why you're here, counsel?
That's not the only reason I'm here, because I think the Court of Appeals seriously misinterpreted the statute and, in effect, read out the language which the district attorney plans to use in the course of the trial. I think Mr. Weiss pointed out that a lot of the discovery obligations are posed in terms of the intent of the prosecutor and made a big point of witness lists, for example. Could the prosecutor say, well, I'm not sure I'm going to need this witness? Well, the statute, in effect, says, with regard to witness lists, a list of all witnesses that the prosecutor must disclose, list of all witnesses, this paragraph does not apply to rebuttal witnesses or those called for impeachment purposes only. And I think that's a recognition within the statute that a witness who the district attorney might intend to call only as a rebuttal witness need not be disclosed.
Counsel, I need help with this. The statute 971.23 deals with discovery and inspection. I've always thought of this generally as discovery before trial, inspection before trial. That's the way it plays out in the courts around the state. And indeed, the language, the first sentence of that statute indicates the district attorney shall, within a reasonable time before trial. So it's not just practice, it's the statutory language. Yet your interpretation would have it that the norm is that during trial, when the prosecutor makes the decision to use the defendant's statement, that focus of your interpretation of sub B is a focus that will play out during trial rather than before trial. And before trial is what the statute, I thought, primarily is about. So your focus is inconsistent with what I think is the primary intent of the statute. Can you address that?
Well, I think it's one, the statute certainly recognizes in sub 7 the continuing duty to disclose that there may come up times during trial.
Sure, I understand.
And I think in the case, this is the case where the duty arose during trial, one.
But your definition would have it consistently during trial. That's my problem. The way you define intend to use, that language doesn't come into play with regard to a defendant's statement generally, except during trial.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. If it's apparent that the defendant's statement is going to be used in the case in chief, where the state obviously has a pretty good idea of what it's going to be doing in its case in chief. So if the oral statement is one that the prosecutor, there's no room for argument that a prosecutor would be intending to use that statement as part of the case in chief.
Well, yeah.
Then
that's right. I mean, that could possibly come in. Generally, it comes in impeachment, and you only impeach when the defendant testifies.
I think that statements of the defendant often come in not just for impeachment, and that's what this is talking about. I'd like to make a couple other quick points. Oh, I see my
very quickly. Just go ahead.
Justice Sykes asked whether there were any other cases and whether this imputed knowledge applies in the context of the intent to disclose, and counsel gave the answer, the illustration of the Wald case, which involves scientific testing. My recollection of the Wald case is that it predated the statute. It was not a case interpreting the statute. Rather, it was interpreting the prosecutor's promise to disclose certain things. That were made. So if that Wald was not a statutory case. And I have no other points that are so pressing that I'll impose limits.
Do you want to go over your red light? Well, thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Castle. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. That concludes our hearing on...